From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're devoting today's show to stories about the Revolutionary War as we celebrate the 4th of July. We'll revisit my conversation with author and historian Nathaniel Philbrick. He joined us a couple of years ago to discuss his book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. We'll also hear my conversation with author and humorist Sarah Vowell, who detailed the role of the teenage Frenchman, the Marquis de Lafayette, in shaping the revolution. But first, Benjamin Franklin's overlooked sister. She was a close confidant to her prominent brother. The two carried on an extensive correspondence through the founding of our country. We learned about her and the role of women in the days of the Revolutionary War when we were joined by Harvard history professor Jill Lepore. That's all ahead here on WHYY. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and welcome to the Independence Day edition of Radio Times. Benjamin Franklin's image and legacy are part of Philadelphia's DNA. Not only did he possess one of the most influential minds in shaping our country, but his contributions to science and his intriguing personal life have made him one of the most towering figures of the Revolutionary period. So it's not surprising that his correspondents have become a source of interest for historians. Many of these letters were written to elites from all over the world. But Harvard historian Jill Lepore found his correspondence with his sister Jane to be particularly illuminating, not only about Franklin's relationship with his family, but the role that women played in the Revolutionary period. She joined me in the studio a couple of years ago to discuss the Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Let's take a listen. What got you interested in her? Because she's been buried by history.
Yeah, you know, what happened was one day when I had this thing that a lot of avid readers do, that when you fall in love with someone as a writer, you desperately want to read everything they ever wrote, right? Like when you're a kid and you read Ramona the Pest, you need to read every Henry Huggins story. Like you need to read every Beverly Cleary book. So I had that from childhood. And when I was in college, I got really interested in Benjamin Franklin.
He's
such a delightful and charming writer. Like, his voice just leaps off the pages. He's funny, he's smart. It's just quite challenging in ways. It's a very sly writer. So I one day decided I would read everything that Franklin ever wrote. And this is an easy thing to do because, of course, there's a whole Benjamin Franklin industry, as nobody knows better than the inhabitants of Philadelphia.
Indeed. And you're welcome. Yes.
So I went to the library where, you know, since the 1950s, the Benjamin Franklin Papers Project has been compiling everything he ever wrote and printing it in these published volumes. And I pulled one volume after another off the shelf, like slumped down into the floor the way I would do in the library. It's like 40-something volumes. And I just kept reading day in and day out. And I was just gobsmacked. Every other letter seemed to be to this sister of his named Jane, whom I had never heard of before.
Did you have to use, though, your historian and journalistic skills to create her? Because you only had sort of bits and sort of shards of her life and her personality. Even.
Yeah, it's really tricky also because even for the years when her letters do survive, they're lovely and fascinating, but still, he's Benjamin Franklin. They're never on equal terms at any point. Like, he's off, you know, she's like, why don't you write to me? And he's like, well, I've been a little busy. You know, like, he's at the Constitutional Convention. Or she's like, I need some firewood. And he's like, well, I've been in Paris. You know, like, it's not like writing about Franklin's correspondence with John Adams, or even like Abigail's correspondence with John Adams. Like, they had similar kind of standards of education. But I'm really interested in that asymmetry because it tells us so much.
Sure.
Like, we live with all kinds of inequality and huge social and political problems that face us today are basically questions about inequality. Why not, as a historian, shouldn't we actually look carefully at inequality, even in the archives, even in the survival of the historical record? What does that tell us? Not to just sort of say, oh, that's a problem, that's difficult, we can't solve that, but say, how could we solve that?
But what's interesting is how much he seemed to rely on her. I mean, how much he valued their relationship as brother and sister.
Yeah, he really, really cares about her. And it's quite a generous and loving side of Franklin, who a lot of people find him fairly mischievous and somewhat unreliable as a character. And in many ways, he's a kind of duplicitous fellow. But the earnestness of his affection for her, his incredible generosity towards her and towards her children is, I think, really quite a moving thing and casts him in a new light.
Well, in fact, you quote one of his letters, "Dear sister, I've always judged by your behavior when a child that you would make a good, agreeable woman, and you know you were my particular favorite, or my peculiar favorite, I should say. Then he goes on to write, I hear you are grown a celebrated beauty.
Yeah.
I mean, there are no pictures of her, but in his mind, perhaps, or his
eye. And there's also, you know, he's a flattering fellow, and 18th century letters are like that. You'd be very coy, and you would say that, you know, she's 14 when he writes that, and he's actually writing to her to say, please watch out for your virginity. I hear you've grown very, very beautiful, and I know that you're just like me. Like, you're saucy, and you're cheeky, and you're miffy and easily irritated, and you're full of pride. And he, you know, this is Franklin, who's just really gotten back from a season of sleeping with prostitutes in London. Like, he has had a very errant youth, and he got away with it. And he knows that she wouldn't get away with that. And he knows that she is very much like him. Yeah. And he also knows what that can consign her to by way of a fate. She's 14 when he writes that he was right to worry. She marries at 15. She was probably pregnant.
You think she might have been pregnant at the time?
Well, it was illegal to marry at 15 without your parents' approval, because the legal age was 16, but the average age was 24, and all of her sisters married at around age 24. It was really weird to marry at 15, and the guy she married was very poor, so if her parents gave their approval, it was probably because she was pregnant.
Your book is called Book of Ages, which is really based on a small book that she kept about the sort of birth and death of her 12 children.
Yeah, you know, Franklin, again, so famous for the autobiography, writes the story of his life, rising from rags to riches. And I thought, when I found out that there was this little sort of, it was described as a, you know, in a catalog as a journal kept by Jane Franklin Meekham, and I went into the archives to see it, and it's this tiny, tiny little slip of a thing, like a little patch
of
burlap. It's four sheets of foolscap that she's folded and stitched together with this quite coarse thread. And then on the first page, she's really ornate, in this ornate hand, Book of Ages. This is like kind of chilling phrase, you know. What is a Book of Ages? I like kept looking, what does that even mean? It isn't actually used very often in the 18th century. It actually means a book of the dead. But she, and it starts, you know, Jane Franklin born March 27, 1712, like an autobiography would start, like you're something full of just expectation and thrill, like, wow, Jane Franklin wrote an autobiography, that's going to be so great to sort of look at against Franklin's story of his life. And then, you know, you read down, and it's actually a chronicle of the births and deaths of her 12 children with prayers.
She is very resourceful. I mean, she, you know, she takes in works, laundry and sewing. She takes in boarders. I guess when she becomes a widow, she needs to make money to support the family. Brings in boarders, but not just any boarders. I mean, these are people, political people that are living in her house.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to think about what you would do if you were an 18th century married woman married to someone who really couldn't work. Like, her husband basically at a certain point, well after they've had their 12 children, can no longer work. Right. Like, married women cannot own property. They cannot earn wages. Like, legally, they do not exist, right? You are a covered woman. You're covered by the man. Like, there's very, very little you can do. So you see in newspapers, in the back of the newspapers in the 18th century, you see women selling their breast milk.
Oh, wow.
Because it's a thing you can do. And you think about what that means. Like,
first, you're having babies all the time.
You're having babies. You always have milk. And you're often depriving your own children of milk in order to sell milk. So it's a very hard, very, very hard economic times in the 18th century. One of the reasons that the revolution comes about is people are really, the working class are really suffering. And, Jane, one of the few things she can do is take in boarders. And it happens that, she's in Boston, and probably through Franklin and his own connections and ties and his many correspondents in Boston, she ends up taking boarders who are mostly members of the Massachusetts Assembly.
Wow.
So these are these guys, you know, sort of Sam Adams, John Hale kind of guys who are debating what to do about the Stamp Act and what to do about the Townsend Acts and what to do about the Tea Act, and they're living in her house. And so Franklin, she then becomes a really kind of valuable correspondent for Franklin in a completely different way, because she can say, well, I've been hearing a very interesting conversation at dinner this evening.
And would she correspond that
way? Yeah. I mean, she would say, and I've listened a lot. And, you know, she didn't, she was quite discreet. And Franklin had clearly spoken to her about discretion, because there was a lot of political intrigue. A lot of what was going on was vaguely treasonous, and then later, you know, literally treasonous. And so Franklin had to be very protective of what anybody could put in the mail in a letter to him. So there's a lot of their corners for, like, you have been too free with me. so you
kind of, that's kind of code word.
Yeah. But again, like, she's not only reading, you know, Swift or you know, 18th century political thinkers, she's listening to these debates in her very house.
She says, "I do not pretend to write about politics," she once wrote her brother, "you write, though I love to hear them." Then you say she did more than listen.
She does do more than listen because she has her own ideas. You know, one of my favorite moments is when Franklin is, she comes to Philadelphia for the American Revolution because Boston has been, you know, taken over by the British. And Franklin rides up to Cambridge, where Washington is headquartered, with a carriage to rescue Jane and bring her back to Philadelphia. And it's like the happiest time for her life. She's like, "Well, you know, the world is going to hell in a handbasket.
But
I have this like really long carriage ride with my brother, whom I haven't seen in years, and I adore him. And they have this like incredibly fun long ride. And then she lives with him while he's, you know, meeting with the Continental Congress. So, you know, just right down the street and having Tom Paine over for dinner. You know, she's listening. And the problem is, of course, when people live in the same house together, what happens? They don't write letters to one another anymore. So,
but it's clear
there's a bit of a veil over that little period. But it's clear she's in the middle of everything. She couldn't be more in the middle of everything. But my favorite sort of piece of their political exchange is when she's back in Boston after the war. He buys her a house in the North End. And when Franklin's in Philadelphia for the Continental Constitutional Convention, you know, they're sequestered. They're not allowed to write letters during the whole time. And it's, you know, it's from May to September in 1787. And, you know, the last letter Franklin writes before he's sequestered is to Jane. And the first letter he writes when he gets out is to Jane. And she writes him a letter right before he's going into the Constitutional Convention. And she says, "I just have one thing that I want you gentlemen in Philadelphia to think about. No guns."
Oh, wow.
"No guns. We should all, you know, beat our swords into plowshares." Like, there's just, she's really suffered during the war, the actual act of war. The violence on the streets in Boston, the British soldiers just attacking people. She lost a son who fought in the Battle of Bunker Hill. She just wants the members of the Constitutional Convention to think about guns.
It's interesting. You mentioned Abigail Adams. I mean, it's interesting to think about Jane Franklin's correspondence with her brother and Abigail and John Adams' correspondence with each other. I mean, both, I guess, what each got from each other, but also how different they were, obviously.
Yeah, they're really different. I mean, Abigail Adams is, again, like incredibly well-educated and in a traditional and learned sense. Jane is a hardscrabble, self-taught, rebellious woman living in very different circumstances than Abigail Adams. They would not have met.
Right.
Although John Adams is the one who after everybody flees Boston in 1775, he's the one who gets a message to Franklin that his sister has survived and that she's hiding in Rhode Island. So they're in a world of conversation in some small way. But Abigail meets John on the page as an equal because he accepted that from her. I mean, that was part of their affection and their relationship. She's just not representative in that way. Mm-hmm. Jane speaks from a different, completely different social position, and
more deferential.
She's more deferential to him all through their lives until the very end, when she comes into her own as a much older woman, mm-hmm. and then and also in the wake of the revolution, really transforms her. I mean, you see the power of a shifting conversation in the whole of the Western world about the relationship between their people and their rulers. And you see that is the roots of all struggles for equality, right? Like, not all of them are realized right away, but you see how much that shapes what she is willing to say to her brother.
Feels more like an equal to her brother who helped create this country.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's just, she speaks her mind in a wholly different way.
That was my 2013 conversation with Harvard professor of history Jill Lepore. She joined me to discuss her book, The Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. When we get back from our very short break, we'll hear my conversation with humorist and historian Sarah Vowell. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 4th of July edition of Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us again, and I hope you are enjoying the day. New York Times bestselling author Sarah Vowell has a knack for combining anecdotal episodes from our American past with her particular brand of humor and passion for history. Her book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States, examined the role that a teenage French aristocrat played in the American Revolutionary War. She joined us in the studio last year to discuss her book and the enigmatic Marquis de Lafayette. Let's take a listen.
What's interesting is that it seems, I mean, clearly you love the Marquis de Lafayette, but it seems that America largely loves Lafayette.
They certainly used to. I don't know, like, nowadays he's more of a place instead of a person, you know? I mean, after he came back in the 1820s, and it was this 13-month-long love fest, partly because he was the last living general from the Continental Army. All the old founders were dead or dying, and that trip inspired everyone everywhere. Because he visited all the states at the time, the naming craze that we're left with.
Because he went to all these various places. And it's interesting that you describe that, because we're here in Philadelphia. The Pope was in the city not so long ago. There was a complete sort of shutdown of center city Philadelphia to allow so many people to come in to see the Pope. And yet it sounded like, at least in New York City, what, half of the city came out to see Lafayette?
Yeah, more than half. I mean, Philadelphia was a really big deal, too. I think they had, in Philadelphia, they had hired this French chef to make this meal, this multi-course meal that was so elaborate, and it was so hot out that the chef actually died from the effort. But his visit to Philadelphia on that trip was very sweet and sentimental, and he goes to Independence Hall, or he calls it the Hall of Independence, and, you know, talks about the importance of what happened in that building.
I do want to have you read from the beginning of your book, but I have to say your book reminded me that Lafayette was a teenager. What, he was 18, 19 years old when he came to the colonies to fight against the British. I mean, you think of, I realize people didn't live as long back then, but nonetheless, really a teenager who came to find, I think, himself here in this country.
Yeah, I mean, he came for a few reasons. One of them was that the British had killed his father in the previous war, so he had a bit of a grudge. Another reason was he actually believed in the Enlightenment ideals about liberty and equality. But, I mean, he was only 19, but he came from a military family and grew up in that French military tradition and culture, and had been to writing school with future kings of France and was part of the King of France's household troops. So he actually had way more military experience than most of the grunts on the ground around here.
In fact, you also remind us that the colonists who fought against the British, I mean, the soldiers were hungry. Many of them sort of fought almost near naked. I mean, it's really kind of I realize the book is full of humor, but it's really pretty shocking to be reminded how truly desperately needy these soldiers were.
I know. I mean, it's very meaningful around here because of Valley Forge and that, you know, classic visual of Valley Forge of the bloody footprints in the snow, because the soldiers were marching there in the winter, and many don't have shoes. And, you know, I mean, Lafayette talks about that and how, you know, they had to amputate the limbs, and then they had to set up their Camp Crummy, I call it, and you know, 2,000 of them die of malnutrition and disease and exposure, and it's kind of an embarrassment. Partly, I mean, it's because the Continental Congress couldn't get it together to supply them with food and supplies and shoes and other luxuries like water, you know. So it's kind of a humanitarian fiasco. And then, you know, spring comes,
right,
as it does, and
yes,
the ones who lived are retrained, and then it becomes the Valley Forge story of them becoming a professional army and trotting off to victory.
I feel like I've seen that movie, perhaps as a child. Well, you visited a number of historic sites, Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly were just outside of Philadelphia, Brandywine Battlefield as well. I mean, that is certainly part of your research.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, Pennsylvania figures in very a lot to the Lafayette story because, I mean, he was wounded here. It's here he comes when he first, you know, arrives in America trying to get a job. Valley Forge. He was there for part of that winter. So, yeah, Pennsylvania is kind of central to his time in the war.
You quote Jefferson about Lafayette's, quote, foible as a canine appetite for popularity. It also seemed like he had daddy issues. The way you write about it, he saw George Washington as a kind of surrogate father.
Yeah, I mean, canine. He does have a puppy dog quality. It's part of his charm, but it probably does get on the nerves a bit, too. I mean, he was an orphan. He was an orphan by the time he was 11, so he did kind of have that orphan's. And he was also an only child, you know, which adds to the petulance, I think. No, I don't know if you're an only child, but...
No, I have one, but that's okay. No, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Well, you know what they're like. So, yeah, he did have this kind of yearning to be well-liked, but it had practical effects. Like, you know, he wanted Washington to like him, so he worked really hard, and he always pitched in. He was very gung-ho. Meanwhile, a lot of the Americans were just deserting in droves because they were like... I need food and money and shoes, and I'm not getting them here. But here was this kid who just wanted everyone to love him.
And apparently George Washington did,
others. Yeah. I mean, Lafayette...
He seemed kind of lovable.
He was. I mean, he has a certain... I guess he always used French words. He had a joie de vivre and a je ne sais quoi.
Oh, altogether.
Yeah. But, I mean, I wouldn't have been interested in him if he was just... a flirty swashbuckler. I mean, he really did work hard. And even after the war, you know, a lot of the ways he helped the new American nation were really boring grown-up things like helping Nantucket whalers get the contract to light the street lamps of Paris. You know, he wasn't just this kid wanting a bunch of attention. I mean, he, like... That's love, you know.
That's love and a lot of hard work. He did, though, leave behind a wife. He left behind a child, a pregnant wife.
Yeah, they already had a child. I mean, they were so young when they got married, and she was a teenager, too, and he left her behind. She was pregnant, and yeah, I don't let him off the hook for that.
No. Do we know how she felt about that? We know what he said to her.
Could have been happier, you know. She was really sad. I mean, she loved him, but she was kind of the perfect wife for him because she believed in him and was, you know, constantly taking care of him and being on his side.
We were talking about some of the women folk that the men left behind, I guess.
I mean, the war, you know, the first shots of the war fired in 1775, but the rebellion goes back 10 years before that when to the Stamp Act. And there were, you know, 10 years of resistance. And the women were really at the forefront of resisting Parliament's taxes upon them, and especially through boycotts and boycotting luxury goods from Britain, especially fabrics. It's sort of the... advent of the homespun movement. I was always also thinking about, like, you know, the Boston Tea Party and how, you know, that's still inspirational right. to civic-minded hotheads today. But really, you know, the way a lot of colonial women in hordes dealt with that was they just swore off tea. And then they would do things like, let's boil basil in water to make us feel better. But really, I was thinking about that. And, like, what is more valiant, like throwing crates off a dock or years and years of taking care of children from dawn until dark without caffeine, you know?
Television.
Oh, God.
Well, let me quote you to you and to our listeners. This is about visiting Brandywine Valley to trace a soldier's steps. I don't think I see American history as war. I see it as a history of argument, a daily docket of estrangement and tiffs, big and grand like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, big and stupid like the impeachment of President Clinton, or small and civil like what's happening at this moment with these strangers in these pews. This is you talking about being some Quakers.
These strangers were Quakers. Yeah, I'm sure around here you've had...
We know about Quakers around here. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But the idea that this is – that we're one big, long-standing argument. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that's what's happening today.
Oh, Completely. I mean, when Lafayette gets here, he's kind of surprised by how much discord there is amongst the American side. And, you know, there's a whole conspiracy to fire George Washington. And Lafayette writes Washington from across the camp at Valley Forge, basically saying, I feel, and this is only after he'd been here for 5 months, I feel like the Americans can defend themselves, like, they can successfully fight the British if they would just stop fighting with each other, you know. And Washington replies about the fatal tendency of disunion. And I mean, that certainly comes from the beginning, you know, down the road at Independence Hall. I talk about, like, the first thing that happened in the Continental Congress, one guy said, let's start with a prayer. The second thing that happened is two Episcopalians stand up and say, no way, we have too many religions, we can't pray together. And maybe they should have just called it quits right then and saved us all a lot of heartache, you know. But I ultimately came to believe that that is not our failing. I mean, this argumentative strain of our culture, which is so part of our DNA and comes from this town and the people who gathered here and established a government based on the separation of powers. I mean, that inspires
That's a lot of separation.
No, it's not a failing. I think it's our strength. I mean, sure, it makes things inefficient and constantly annoying. And especially for me working on this project, because I was trying to research during the government shutdown of 2013 and Independence Hall was closed. But the book ends talking about places named after Lafayette, and I'm making the claim that to me the most meaningful one is Lafayette Square across from the White House, where people protest.
Absolutely.
And the disagreeability of preserving independence that goes on there, and how not only do we get to protest there, you know, if some foreign dignitary is in town from some less than democratic place, his citizens will come to Lafayette Park and protest him in America, because if they did that back home, they would be thrown in jail. And I see that as, like, something we can all be really proud of. And this constant, like, you know, yelling and argument and debate, while it does have its disadvantages, it is the privilege and the right of a free people. Wow, I'm getting all pontificating. I think this town brings it out in me.
Well, and even a reminder of what happened in Yorktown, as you say, without the punctuation of French gunpowder, it could have been a different result in that battle.
For sure. I mean, there was the French were helping the Americans secretly for a couple of years, but then in, I think, 1778, they signed the official, thanks to your boy Ben Franklin, they signed the official Treaty of Alliance, and that's when France sends over gunpowder and guns and cannons and the Navy and the Army and Rochambeau and you know, they at Yorktown, which is basically the conclusive battle of the Revolution, there are more French sailors and soldiers at Yorktown than Americans, and it's the French Navy blockading the British General Cornwallis, who's, like, hemming him in at Yorktown. That's why he surrenders, and that's basically the end of things.
Well, I love the way you describe the French soldiers. You say, as if stepping out of a Tchaikovsky ballet directed by Wes Anderson, the French soldiers wore plumed black hats and white on white, brightening their snowy leggings and jackets with pops of color on the lapels. They're sometimes pink lapels. Obviously, in contrast to the...
They're still French. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
In contrast to the nearly naked American soldiers.
I know. It was a kind of... I mean, one of the, you know, one of the French soldiers or one of the French officers in his journal, he writes about George Washington hosting them in his tent for dinner. And the French officer is appalled because Washington serves them the dinner all on one plate. And there's kind of this vibe like, are these people animals? You know, one plate, no courses. But then, you know, once these French soldiers who are so well-fed and well-trained, they see what these, you know, ragtag bumpkins can do on the battlefield, they do win their grudging respect.
And were the French supporting the Americans as a proxy war against the British?
Oh, for sure. I mean, especially in the beginning when it was all just secret, because for one thing, the French were still broke from being beaten by the British in the Seven Years' War, or what we call the French and Indian War. So they're secretly sending some gunpowder and supplies and stuff through the playwright Beaumarchais to... I can't remember how the French foreign minister puts it, you know, basically to, like, keep up their morale, to keep the Americans harassing Great Britain. But it takes them a while to decide, like, do we want to enter this war officially? Because when they do sign the Treaty of Alliance, Britain declares war on France. And France spends so much money on our war. They were already pretty well bankrupt, and this pretty much, you know, destroys them and leads to the financial crisis that sparks the revolution and gets our ally, His Most Christian Majesty, King Louis XVI, he loses his head over it, you know.
Well, it's interesting that we have today such a fondness, as a country, for the British, less so for the French.
I mean, that was sort of true during the Revolution, too. The French-American alliance had its rough spots. And, you know, the first thing that happened before that second wave of Rochambeau in Yorktown, they sent over this little fleet, and the fleet got destroyed in a storm, and the French fleet abandoned these American army and militias in Rhode Island, and everyone in New England just erupted with anger at the French. And, you know, a lot of the Americans talk about our ancient prejudices, which go back, because they had only been American for like 3 years, and they had been British for hundreds of years. And these animosities between the British and the French go back to, you know, at least the Norman invasion in 1066. So, I mean, one guy in Boston, there was a riot against the French, and a French officer who stepped in to, like, try to quell the nerves was killed. And, you know, because it's Boston in the 18th century, and this Frenchman was a Catholic, and so was his corpse, there was a big to-do over whether he could be buried with a Catholic ceremony. And they, basically, the Boston Fathers felt bad about killing their ally, and so they had a secret funeral in King's Chapel in the middle of the night to give this guy a proper burial. So there were some, yeah, there were some rough spots in that alliance.
That was my conversation with humorist and historian Sarah Vowell, who joined us to discuss her book, Lafayette and the Somewhat United States. You're listening to the 4th of July edition of Radio Times. Hope you're enjoying your day. When we return from this short break, we'll hear my conversation about the early days of the American Revolution and the Battle of Bunker Hill. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 4th of July edition of Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. We turn now to the Battle of Bunker Hill, in which British and colonial forces fought for control of Boston Harbor on June 17, 1775. We heard in glorious detail about the battle and its ramifications when National Book Award winner Nathaniel Philbrick was our guest. He joined us in the studio to discuss his book, Bunker Hill: A City, a Siege, a Revolution. Let's listen. Describe for us what Bunker Hill looks like today. Not in 1775, but today.
Well, it's a hill, but it's densely settled with townhouses. But atop it is this obelisk, the granite obelisk that says Bunker Hill. But it's a little bit confusing because the Bunker Hill Monument is actually set atop a hill known as Breed's Hill. And confusion has surrounded this battle basically from the very beginning.
And do you think there's something unique about this battle that has created this confusion, even mythologies? Or do you think that sort of happens with history over time?
It does. It happens all the time. But there's certain ingredients that add to it. This was a battle that should have never happened. What the Americans were trying to do was to stall a British attack. But instead of building a fort on Bunker Hill as they wanted to. It was Breed's Hill, and that fomented this attack. And, you know, what's added to the confusion is Americans think we won the Battle of Bunker Hill. But no, actually, it was the British who won. But, of course, the British would be the ultimate losers in the Revolution, hence some of the confusion.
Well, let's go back to Boston at this time, which you describe as a town on a tiptoe. A little town.
Yeah.
Almost an island town in a way.
Right. Well, you know, if you visited Boston, it bears almost no resemblance to the way it was in 1775. It was a 1.2 square mile island dominated by three hills of almost mountainous proportions, a little town of 15,000 people with a thin neck of land connecting it to the mainland. And it was a port, the largest port in New England, and it was oriented towards this what is a vast Boston Harbor and the ocean beyond. And so everyone was always looking out towards the sea because that's where their trade came from. That was their lifeblood. And so there were church steeples all around, and it was a town on tiptoe, always looking for, you know, the next ship.
But as you have described, this was a town known for its love of liberty, its piety, and its prostitutes. Beacon Hill, which is a very tony part of Boston, as I understand it, was known as Mount Whoredom.
Yes. You know, that was a slightly different reputation than perhaps Bostonians would prefer to have with their city today. But, you know, this was one of the points of my book, and Boston is really the hero of this book. This is about a community. And one of the things I love about Boston, pre-revolutionary Boston, was it was a community like all communities. It was filled with all sorts of kinds of people, good, bad, heroic, cowardly. You know, it was that kind of community. And this is a book about a community under stress that is turned literally inside out by a revolution.
And there were slaveholders in Boston.
I mean, and that is one of the great ironies and paradoxes of the liberty movement at this time. And this was pointed out by the African-American poet Phyllis Wheatley, that many of the patriots own slaves. And, you know, how can you talk about liberty when you actually possess people? And so, you know, it was a movement that applied to only people like ourselves, what would become America, and that sense of tolerance was yet to come.
You also write about a number of the British who were, in a sense, occupying Boston at this time, including Thomas Gage. And I don't want to read too much into what you've written, but you seem to have some sympathy for some of these figures.
Absolutely. You know, I was surprised. I grew up like everyone, thinking it was black and white. You know, it was patriot liberty versus British tyranny, and there was no difference. You know, it was black or – but it wasn't – it was much more complicated than that. This was a war. It would become a war that British generals had no interest in. They were fighting their own people, and Gage embodies the kind of tortured ambivalence of the British military. He was a very decent man, and the irony is he was not only the military commander, he was the royal governor. He did not have martial law while he's there, and so he is respecting the English liberties of the patriot leaders. And this means that as he's there, weapons, gunpowder are leaving Boston and going out into the country towns, manning those militia that he will be ultimately fighting against. And there's nothing he can do about it. And I think that's underappreciated. The fact that we were able to pull off a revolution happened in large part because someone like Gage was respectful of our liberties. And, you know, so it was a complicated situation.
So did Thomas Gage just want to kind of settle things down? I mean, that he was, as you write, he wanted to honor the civil liberties of the patriots, but they did not return the favor. That's one of the things that you write in this
book.
Yeah,
and he was put in an impossible situation. It was his job to impose what was the Boston Port Act, shutting down Boston commercially, which was Britain's overreaction to the Boston Tea Party. And then there was the passage of another intolerable act, as they were called, which was the Massachusetts Government Act, which basically shut down the charter, the way the state, the colony was governed. And this inflamed the entire colony, and there were royal officials were being mobbed, forced to evacuate, to flee to Boston. And he was quickly realizing he was losing complete control of the situation.
So how much of the considerations, I'm thinking about John Hancock, whom you write about, of course, a very important person in the early days of this country, that he had commercial considerations. I mean, that was sort of, he was a businessman.
Right. Well, you know, and the Tea Party was not just an ideological kind of, you know, taxation without representation. There were many merchants who smuggled illegal tea into Massachusetts, and the British were actually offering tea at a cheaper rate that undercut the smuggled tea. And so many merchants, like John Hancock, objected to this because it was going to be money out of their pocket. And so, you know, it's like life today. It's easy to say this is a matter of you know, higher concerns, when actually there's other very immediate concerns that are influencing what people believe.
So what was, I mean, perhaps there were several sparks that led to the Battle of Bunker Hill.
There were, and it's amazing how early it began, in September of 1774. So we're talking, you know, almost 9 months before it all happens. By this time, it's clear things could get really bad. And everyone knows that gunpowder will be the key to it, because no one's making gunpowder in the colonies. It all comes from Great Britain. And if it goes south, they ain't going to be providing gunpowder. And so all the towns start rounding up their own powder, and Gage starts rounding up his powder. And this leads inevitably to increasing tensions.
So we know it is Bunker Hill, but it's actually, as you said, it's really Breed Hill. Did they just confuse their hills as they were?
Yeah,
as they were,
well,
a sense?
You know, the problem was by June of 1775, we've had Lexington and Concord. And so tension in the 60 days that follow that, more and more British soldiers are arriving in Boston. Boston is now besieged. It's surrounded by thousands of militiamen that are based in Cambridge and Roxbury, right next to the neck that goes into Boston. And the British are under pressure to break out, to try a knockout punch that will send this army of provincial soldiers reeling and snuff this out. And so the Patriots get word that the British are about to do this. And so in an attempt to delay it, the order is made to build an earthen redoubt on Bunker Hill, which is on the Charlestown Peninsula. Mm-hmm. Charlestown Peninsula goes head south to within a quarter mile of Boston, where Boston Harbor is just between it. And Bunker Hill was about a half mile away. And putting a fort there would have been a smart move. It would have prevented the British from attacking Cambridge quickly, but it wouldn't have started anything. For reasons that we will never know,
truly,
that night, Colonel William Prescott and his men, about 1,000 men, spend the night building a fort, not on Bunker Hill, but on Breed's Hill, which is right in the figurative face of the British. Dawn comes, and they see that they are surrounded by British warships, all cannon-equipped. Boston, a half mile away, cannons everywhere, bristling, all pointed at them. The cannonballs start firing. And Gage looks and says, I've got to attack this. I can't just let this outrageous act go without a response. And so he tells his subordinate, General William Howe, to lead more than 2,000 British regulars to take this. And this drives the Patriot leadership, wait a minute, we were trying to stop this. And so it was disorganized from the beginning. There's an element of confusion that started it and will forever be attached to it.
So an accident, in a sense, was the spark for the American Revolution.
Yes.
I mean, probably something else would have sparked it at some other later
right.
date or time or place.
Yes. This was a fire just waiting for the match to be lit. And, you know, what this did was exactly what many Patriot leaders wanted, that, you know, hey, this, we need to do something here. Something has to happen. And you wonder, one of the Prescott may have had an underlying motive in doing this. And what happened was the bloodiest battle of the Revolution. The British would eventually take this fort, but it would cost them casualties of almost 50%, which is just terrible.
In fact, you describe over what appears to be a several hour period, just the carnage from this battle.
Yeah, the carnage. And, you know, what made this a different kind of battle was almost a spectator event. There were thousands of Bostonians on their roofs watching. It was just happening right there. It was a sunny, summer-like day. 2,000 British regulars and their glittering regalia marching up this green hill towards the Patriot lines that extended from this fort all the way across the width of Charlestown Peninsula to the Mystic River. You have these cannons being fired from all these surrounding ships. It was horrifying, and people could watch it. You know, it's sort of like how we watch some of these terrible things on TV today. For the 18th century, this was truly extraordinary to have this all happening right before them. And we have this one account from John Burgoyne, a British general who was stationed on Copp's Hill in Boston during this, and he describes the tension they're all feeling, knowing that what was about to transpire could literally change the course of history in the English-speaking world.
And on one side, I'm imagining the British military probably well-organized, well-armed, you know, had a battle plan. I mean, they were, I guess, used to being a member of the military. Then you have this more sort of DIY, do-it-yourself group on the other side trying to hold off the British.
It's a really fascinating study in contrast. You're right. This is one of the best-trained British Army in the world. And with that goes a certain amount of arrogance. What are a group of farmers going to do when they see 2,000 soldiers not only with muskets but with 17-inch bayonets attached to them? Most of the Patriots did not have bayonets, and when it came to this kind of close battle, between a pitched battle between armies, inevitably came down to bayonet charges.
Which means close range, obviously.
Close range, and you fire once, and in the smoke you run and attack and bayonet your opponent. And they kind of assumed the provincials, when faced with this, would run. But what you also see is Prescott created this huge problem by building this fort. But then as other officers arrive, instead of throwing up their hands, they begin to do the best they can to improvise a solution. Mm-hmm. And so you have someone saying, okay, let's extend a breastworks here. And then another guy says, I'll build a rail fence here. And then finally, Colonel John Stark, this grizzled guy from New Hampshire, realizes, oh my gosh, they could just come along the beach, get behind us and attack us from behind. I'll put a stone wall. And that's what really saved the day, because that's exactly what William Howe was going to do. He had a perfect plan drawn up. You know, he'd sneak a group of his crack troops along the beach and get them from the side. But thanks to Stark, who arrived at the last minute, instead of a wide-open back door, they met a stone wall, and more than 100 light infantry, British light infantry, died in just a matter of seconds.
Trying to storm it.
And these British had, many of them were very experienced, had been fighting the Seven-Year War in North America and in Europe, and all of them after the battle said they had never experienced as hot a fire as they had experienced at Bunker Hill.
And did someone say, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes?
It's interesting. There's no we don't have direct evidence. We know someone said, don't fire until you see the whites of the British half-gaiters. That doesn't quite have the same ring.
Someone actually said that?
Yes,
though?
Yes. But the point is, that was what they were doing. They didn't have much powder, and so they knew what powder they had to make work. And so they waited until the British regulars were within 30 yards and then unleashed, and it with horrifying results.
But as you said, the British won. I mean, they lost possibly as many as half of their soldiers, but they won this battle, the Battle of Bunker Hill.
They won. And as Howe, and you got to give Howe, he was a leader who at this time, you didn't lead back there, you know, in the back and say, you go there, you go there. He was with his men on all three charges. He had his entire staff either killed or wounded. At one point, both sides saw him standing alone right beside the Patriot line, you know, on the second charge. Third charge, they succeed. But as he would say, this is success was too dearly bought. And everyone realized after the Battle of Bunker Hill, this is not a few skirmishes that can be negotiated away. We are now out in for a real war.
That was my interview with author Nathaniel Philbrick, who joined me back in 2013 to discuss his book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And that wraps up the 4th of July edition of Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edited this show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for listening. Hope you're enjoying this holiday.